Good day. Okay. I just want to welcome you all to this Library Book Talk series. It's a series that we've been running for a number of years that focuses on books related to topics of interest to us at the JTS, in the library. Very often they are books written by faculty, JTS faculty, or other people connected to JTS. And I want to urge you also, next week we're having our last book talk of it's the last book talk of the season. It is a Festschrift in honor of Neil Gilman, and it is next Tuesday night on the 7th. So please sign up on, or either sign up by sending an email, or you can speak to Hector Guzman afterwards. He will put down your name and your information, and we'll, of course, welcome you next week. I want to thank Maggie Anton for coming this evening, and Judy Houtman for being the
suggesting it
and for being the scholar, the Talmudic scholar who could address some of the issues, fascinating issues of this book that I've really enjoyed reading. And there will be a question and answer period afterwards, and the books will be for sale. And in case you've never been to the library, come by or visit us online. There's a lot you can learn. Thank you.
Okay. Hi. So I'm one of those JTS faculty people who is here tonight to introduce Maggie Anton. And I'm not going to repeat anything in the bio that's on the poster because you got the poster or you saw the bio downstairs. But I met Maggie for the first time in the 1990s. I was teaching at this reform kala at UCSC, that's Santa Cruz. And she told me at the time that you were taking a Talmud class with Rachel Adler, and you got all excited about Talmud. And she told me, maybe it was 92, 93, she said, I am going to write about a trilogy about Rashi's daughters. So I thought, you know, like you smile when you hear something totally absurd. You know, she's never going to carry out. And Maggie didn't know Talmud. And how could she possibly read any of the relevant materials? So I smiled and said, oh, very nice. And we actually took a long walk in the woods and we discussed things. And then, I don't know how many years later, 8 years, 10 years later, whatever it is, the first book comes out, and then the second book comes out, the thing that you need to know is, I hope I'm not disclosing anything I shouldn't disclose, Maggie self-published. The publishers did not have any faith in your book when you first brought it.
And someone here brought me who had all the books here, had me sign with the red cover. Which one? Who held that one up? Okay, hold it up so everybody can see that. You know, I recognize the oldie but moldy. Yeah.
No, that's the new one.
That's the new one. It's a big red one. Oh, she has all four. Of course, it'll be the last one.
It's on the bottom.
It is.
Yay, there it is. So there's the original Benoit Press.
Yes, Benoit Press. Maggie's own press. And then when she energetically began selling this book by hand, you know, hand to hand by the author, all of a sudden it became a great success, and the publishers banged down your door, and then you signed with Penguin because it was just easier for you, even though you didn't have to at that point to do that. So that's one thing I want to say, that it's absolutely incredible that somebody has this idea and carries it out and makes such a success of it. And in addition to that, as I say, I blurbed the third Rashi's daughter, but I read Rafista. You sent it to me as soon as it came out. And I'm not allowed to blurb it because I blurbed one of the other books. But what I particularly loved about Rafista's daughter is that, okay, you know, there's a plot, and we all read for plot, and I love plot, but part of this plot is made up. Some of it isn't, some of it is. But the background details on every page of this volume, I saw details that I was able to associate with this place in the Talmud or that place in the Talmud. So Maggie has not just read all the materials in the Talmud on Rav Chisda's daughter, which are really not all that extensive, and not only all the materials on Rav Chisda, but she's read everything that you could find in the Talmud, which gives you some hint as to everyday lives. So that is my endorsement of this book, which is not going to go in print, but which I'm giving to you verbally. Mm-hmm. And now I introduce to you Maggie Anton.
Well, thank you, Judith, for that fantastic introduction, and I thank you all for coming out on this maybe not rainy evening, hopefully not. It's a great honor to speak at JTS. You know, that and what, and $5 gets me a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But, you know, so it's on my, now it can be on my resume. Well, I spoke at JTS.
Yes.
And indeed, I had no, it's even more unlikely than what Judith talked about, because I have a BS in chemistry from UCLA. I was not a writer. I was a clinical chemist for over 40 years, working for Kaiser Permanente, the big HMO in their chemistry laboratories. I did not take writing classes. I was not in writing groups. I did not keep journals. I tested out a subject A. I did not even take English in college.
Oh,
but what I did, so anyway, don't ask me for writing advice. I'm not even going to go there. But I was a voracious reader of fiction. And when I found Rachel Adler's Talmud class in 1992, which she started in Los Angeles because there was no place a woman could study Talmud in Los Angeles, Southern California being the second largest Jewish community in the world, women were still totally unable to find a place to study Talmud there. You guys have had Drisha forever, but, you know, but in L.A. there was nothing, and that's why she started the class. And I admit, I signed up for it because I wanted to see what was this stuff that Jewish women weren't supposed to study. My Talmud experience at that point consisted of having read The Chosen by Chaim Potok. But I fell in love with Talmud. It's become my passion, as anyone who reads any of my books can, you know, can see. And I continue to study. Now I study individually with Havruta rather than a group. But being in the woman's Talmud class, Rachel pointed out Rashi had no sons, only daughters. Daughters who were reputed to be learned, reputed to wear tefillin. And not knowing what I was getting into, I decided to see if those legends were true. And we have plenty, you know, we have two rabbinic schools in L.A., Judaic libraries in UCLA, and Claremont Colleges and LMU. There are plenty of places I did research. And I found, maybe in a year, evidence that Rashi's daughters were learned. That part, there's no doubt that they were. The tefillin question was a little trickier. And here I am at JTS to give you the definitive answer. Anybody ever wants to know, did Rashi's daughters wear tefillin? The answer is maybe. Because some women in Rashi's community wore tefillin. Some women wore tzitzit, not a talus. Purim shawls are not invented till the 14th century. But they had cloaks, four-cornered garments, and they put tzitzit on the four corners. There was no difference between a man's and a woman. And ritual manuals from that time says if a woman wears tzitzit, she says the blessing. Women blew the shofar in Rashi's time and community. If a woman was sick or had a baby on Rosh Hashanah, they'd send a woman to blow the shofar for her. There were mahalot. Women did circumcisions. And I didn't even put this last one in Rashi's daughters because I didn't want to deal with all the nasty emails that would come. In Rashi's community, women had aliyah to the Torah. You see why I didn't put it in? I was so astonished at finding out all the stuff. I mean, I'm 63. I thought I'm in the first generation of women who are taking on the men's mitzvot. But no, they were, you know, they were doing it 900 years ago. Rashi lived in the 11th century in Troyes, France. And then I started wondering, wait a second, this is, not only is this astonishing, how come nobody knows about it? Here I am studying with Rachel Adler, foremost feminist scholar. She didn't know about it. Nobody knew about it. This was like a black hole in Jewish history. And that's when, okay, the word I'm about to use, most people say figuratively. I say literally, something possessed me to write about Rashi's daughters. And I decided, okay, that I was going to write the book that I wanted to read. I did not expect anyone else to read it, even to begin with. I didn't tell anybody I was reading it, not even my husband or my kids. And it was because I was a voracious reader of novels that I had an idea of what I wanted to do. And not necessarily that I read historical novels. Science fiction, murder mystery, fantasy, thrillers, all kinds of stuff. Kids' books. Regular romance, cheesy romance. Anyway, there was a series of kids' books that I read when I was little, growing up in the 1950s. Because I grew up in a secular socialist household. I went to Kinderschule, not religious school. That's put on by the Workman's Circle people. I learned Yiddish, not Hebrew. And I learned a lot about the Jewish religion from these series of books by Sidney Taylor, All of a Kind Family, which in New York everybody's heard of. You know, when I speak in Alabama, don't count on it. But anyway, so that's what I wanted to do for Rashi's daughters, was to embed the reader, myself, in the family, in their household, do the Jewish life cycle events, do the all the holidays and the food and every, you know, just live the life with the characters in 11th century Troyes. Only, okay, and how many of you have read Rashi's Daughters? Oh, good, there's some of the hands. Listen, unlike most, you would think I would want to see lots of hands. I don't want to see any hands. I want to sell books. But I happen to have already sold out of book one, and they're not sending more till Philadelphia. So anybody who hasn't read book two, I still have some book two. But anyway, those of you who have read Rashi's Daughters know that my books are for adults, as opposed to All of a Kind Family. Two things make them for adults, and I confess, I wrote the book that I wanted to read, and I like a good sex scene as well as anyone. So, and believe me, the Talmud has stuff to say about sex that would curl your hair. And so that's in there, but also there's Talmud study in there. In Rashi's Daughters, the daughters study with him, students study with him, you get Talmud straight taught from Rashi's mouth. It drove me crazy reading The Chosen, where the whole plot is based on the yeshiva world. The heroes are two yeshiva students. Talmud study pervades the whole place, and there's not a line of Gemara in there. So I said, Rashi is the great Talmud scholar. This is what he's famous for. His daughters are famous for being learned. They're going to study Talmud in there. And that was one of the things I asked Judith. First thing is, and she must have thought I was crazy, when I asked her, I need a really good Rashi. I need a place where the Talmud text is completely unintelligible without Rashi's commentary. That there's no way you could ever figure out what was in there. And lo and behold, you were teaching one. The thing about Tarsha.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, if Rashi doesn't tell you what Tarsha is, yes. The whole sugya is you know, might as well be in Greek. And it ended up in book one that I used that sugya. Anyway, flash forward a few years, and we have book one and book two, and book three of Rashi's Daughters are out there. They're successful. So naturally, my editors at Penguin, I don't know whether they asked or hinted. I mean, already, and do you have any, what are you planning to write? Anything else? Any other books for the Jewish audience? I had lunch with my editors today, and they were asking me, like, what am I going to do? Do you have any ideas for after Rav Hizda? So I told them, actually I told them yes, but the answer was maybe, because I had been intrigued with Rav Hizda's daughter way early on in Talmud. I had found her, come across her, and I'll tell you in a few minutes why I was just fascinated by her. But the story of Rav Hizda's daughter, I wasn't sure that it would qualify to be a book that I wanted to read. And I must admit, when I started telling people that I was writing about Rashi's Daughters, the response, at least among Jewish women, was, wow, I can't wait to read it. And I remember thinking, are you kidding? This could be the world's worst book. I don't have any writing experience. But I found there was a hunger among Jewish women in particular for novels with Jewish heroines, and if they were historical Jewish heroines, even more so. Remember, we're talking the early 1990s. The Red Tent is the only one that's out there like that. But now, of course, when I tell people I'm writing about Rav Hizda's daughter, what's the big response? Who? So, even though, you know, all you guys are, you know, I don't know how many of you are JTS students and know everything I'm going to tell you, but I'm going to give you the very short, and when I say very short, this is going to be less than 10 minutes, of what is Talmud, who's Rav Hizda, and why these guys are important. Rav Hizda, you can tell by the name, is a rabbi. I'm not going to take advantage of the chalkboard. This is my advertisements here. Rav Hizda lives in 3rd century Babylonia. And at the time he lives, Jews have lived in Babylonia, and this is modern-day Iraq. Now it's a desert. Back then it was the Fertile Crescent, the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And Jews have lived there for 1,000 years. They left the land of Israel when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first temple. It's my phone. Who's calling me?
I should get rid of it.
And it's not anybody in my family's ring, so I don't have to deal with that. And okay. I'll leave a message. Normally I do a cell phone announcement and tell people that I don't care if their cell phone's on, they can do whatever they want with it because, you know, they could be tweeting, they can be taping it for YouTube, they can be putting it on Facebook. My daughter twice, extremely inconveniently, had babies in November, Jewish Book Month, when I was on book tour. And I had to be listening. If the phone rang and it was like my son-in-law or my husband's ring, it was like, that's it, I'm gone. So I don't know what's with your phones and what you're waiting for. My rule is your cell phone goes off during my lecture. You have to write copies of all my books. Now I only have two of them, but anyway, hopefully they won't call back. That's a very unusual thing for someone to be calling you while I'm talking. All right, back to Rav Hizda. The Jews were taken out of the land of Israel by Nebuchadnezzar when the first temple was destroyed. And 70 years later, the prophet Ezra brings them back, except he doesn't bring them all back. A bunch of decide, we like it here in Babylonia, we're going to stay. And they're still there 1,000 years later. The land is very prosperous. The Jews are merchants. The Silk Road goes right through there. They're landowners. They're growing all kinds of nice crops. They're living in peace and prosperity because they're living under the Persians, under the Zoroastrians, who are not proselytizing, who are not persecuting them. The Persians are perfectly happy for the Jews to have their own self-government, their own leaders, their own courts, as long as they pay their taxes and don't revolt. So everything is very nice in Persia. Meanwhile, next door in the land of Israel, things couldn't be worse. The Romans have taken over there. The first temple was destroyed in 70, the first generation CE, when the Jews revolted. They then revolted again with Bar Kokhba, and at that point, Rome lays waste to Jerusalem and the entire south of Israel, the whole land of Judea. They didn't salt it because I've heard that's too expensive, but they did something to make the crop not be able to plant anything. And they either killed all the priests and population and or sent them as slaves to Rome. So there's, and to add insult to injury, they changed the name from Judea to Palestinia, in case you wondered where that came from. So in the land of Israel, we now have no temple, no priesthood. Jerusalem is ruins. How are you going to do Judaism? The Jews in the south are still there, but how can they do it? They can't go to the temple. How do you celebrate most of your holidays? According to the Torah, you take an animal, you go to the priest, you sacrifice, you have a barbecue, and you go home. You have to go to the priest if you're impure for umpteen reasons, skin diseases, who knows what. Yom Kippur, you don't have to do anything. The priest puts his hands on the goat. All the sins of Israel are transferred there. They throw the goat off the cliff, and you're done. So without, now we've had 200 years without a temple, almost, and the Christians are starting to make some inroads. They say God has broken the covenant with the Jews by destroying the temple, and we've got this new covenant over here for you. So some of this is kind of anachronistic, and remember, this is the 10-minute Talmud lesson. But in the north of Israel, the folks who were going to be called the rabbis are coming into existence, and they are trying to figure out, how can we do Judaism with no temple, with no priesthood, with no city of Jerusalem? And it's not like they sat around the table and had a committee meeting and everybody voted. But somehow they came up with the idea that we are changing the focus of Judaism to Torah. And we now, if we focus on Torah instead of having the temple, we will have a portable religion. It does not depend on any hereditary priesthood. It does not depend on any city, any country, anything like that. But in order to focus on Torah, we need to know what's in there. And so they decide we need to come up with a new book. Because let's say you wanted to know all the laws of Shabbat. You'd have to know the whole Torah by heart. So they say, okay, we're going to take all the laws of Shabbat, put them in one chapter of this new book, which is not the New Testament, although it is contemporary with the New Testament. And they're all going to be in this chapter of this new book, and the chapter is going to be called Shabbat. And there's also going to be some of this new stuff that we've come up with, we, the rabbis, on how to do Shabbat when we don't have a temple. Same thing with the chapter on all the laws of Passover. We're going to have that in chapter Pesachim, including this new chapter, the 10th chapter, that tells you how to do a Seder. Whoever heard of a Seder from the Torah? But now you got four questions, and you got four cups of wine, and this whole new dinner party procedure. We're going to come up with chapters on all the holidays. Shavuot, you can't do first fruits anymore. There's no temple. There's no agriculture anyway. And the rabbis figure out, very nice, some addition and mathematics that proves that when did we get Torah? When did the Ten Commandments come down with Moses? On Shavuot. The focus of Shavuot changes from first fruits to the giving of the Torah. Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, well, no goat, now you've got to do some work. We got this Book of Life. Whoever heard of the Book of Life in the Torah? But no, the rabbis have it. And we're going to look at your mitzvot. We're going to look at your aveira. And if you have more mitzvot, you'll get written into the Book of Life. If you have more aveira, well, you got 10 days to get your act together. And then you can get written in there. And by the way, in Babylonia, where all of this is happening, which is the the land of the Chaldeans and the astrologers, the astrological sign for Tishrei, the month when we're doing these things, is the scales. And there's no coincidence there. The Zoroastrians, which is the religion of the Persians, they've already figured out that people are judged on their sins and when they die. But they say when they die. Jews, like, we're going to do them one better. You're going to get judged every year. So all kinds of changes, new things are coming in. And they have not just laws on the holidays, but laws on women, marriage, divorce, nidah, betrothal, and then laws on the courts, laws on buying and selling. And pretty soon you got this new book, which is probably about this fat, called the Mishnah. And that gets compiled in 200 CE. And there we have this law book. And of course, as soon as you have a law book, somebody's going to say, well, wait, what about this case? It's not in your law book. And what about this chapter of Mishnah? It contradicts what's in that chapter in Mishnah. What are we supposed to do about this? And depending on how you want to label the guys who are asking these questions, you could say they're wise men. You could say they're wise guys. Maybe same people. And these being Jews, do you think they get answers to those questions? They get more answers than their wise men, and they get even more questions. So that means you need the first generation of wise people. Well, no, they're all men. Men who now have to ask questions not only about the Mishnah, but about the first generation. Then they have to ask questions, and of course they get more answers, even more answers, even more questions. And as long as we're on the subject of Rabbi Akiva, let me tell you this story. And then the next generation, and the next generation, and you have more questions, and more questions, and more answers, and more answers. And finally, in about 550, so who's the rabbi, who's the last one? Who's the guy who says?
Rav Ashi is considered to be the editor.
Okay, so Rav Ashi, thank you. Rav Ashi says, Dayenu, enough. Not that they're going to stop having questions and answers, but we're just not going to keep track of them anymore here. And you now have, instead of just this book of Mishnah, which is one book, you now have 350 years of what is the Gemara, a whole bookcase full of books, and together the two of them are the Talmud. And that's what the Talmud is. That's where it came from. And the Talmud has been the source of Jewish law and Jewish tradition for the last 1,500 years. We are all rabbinic Jews now. Orthodox, Reconstructionist, Conservative, Reform, we are all following the Talmud. Even the Jews who don't do Judaism, it's rabbinic Judaism they don't do. We have all become Talmudic Jews now. And so here we are, in... Who was Rav Hisda? Finally, you get to the answer to the question. He's one of those wise men, wise guys, what... He's from the 3rd century in Babylonia. He's very early on in the Talmud. And by the way, modern scholars now say that the few hundred rabbis mentioned in the Talmud are all there were out of those million Jews living in Babylonia, and that most of the population, the Jewish population, had either never heard of a rabbi, they'd never met a rabbi, and frankly, if they knew anything about rabbis, they were quite skeptical. And if not downright antagonistic. It's like, who gave them the authority to innovate all these new things for Judaism? Who gave them the authority to say, I got to do 100 blessings a day? To say that these books are going to be in the canon and these books aren't? And what Torah portion I'm going to read on Shabbat and Haftorah, and I'm supposed to read Ruth on Shavuot, and all the many rules that the rabbis innovated in the Talmud. Most of the Jews at this time were not enthusiastic and did not recognize the rabbi's authority. And actually, I gave this speech at some synagogue, and the rabbi in the audience said, and so what's different now? To which I have no answer. But so we have Rav Hisda as one of these rabbis. And he doesn't have a giant Talmud academy. He has a handful, well, more than a handful. He has, you know, maybe a dozen, two dozen teenage boys that come to his house. They learn Mishnah. They discuss Mishnah. The idea being that if they are clever and learn this, they will get a job with the Jewish court, either in being on the judges, or maybe they can work in the marketplace, making sure the weights and measures are they should be, or perhaps checking the kashrut. It's like law school used to be, where you would go to it and you'd graduate and you were guaranteed a good job with security. So we are in Rav Hisda. You're wondering, like, how long has she been talking? We haven't gotten to Rav Hisda's daughter yet. We're getting there. She is in the classroom with him, Bava Batra 12B. Right away, I have to tell people, I did not make this up. This is where you can find it. You know, if you have a smartphone, you could probably find it, like, right now. But depending on the translation, she's either sitting on his lap or sitting next to him. So she's a young girl. She's maybe 8 or 9 years old. When he calls up his two best students, and he asks her, which do you want to marry? Oh, my, yes. I mean, this is 3rd century Babylonia. How many girls got a choice of anybody? The Talmud says you're supposed to not say yes until you've seen the person, met them, and agree, yes, I want him. But on the other hand, how many 8 or 9 year old girls would turn down the man that their fathers brought? So anyway, Rav Hisda brought her to these two guys, and he's not asking her in private. They are standing right in front of her. Not only in front of her, they are standing in front of the entire class. So we have quite a dramatic, traumatic situation, potentially. And she says, both of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, someone always says something like that. Yeah, that's how I felt when I read it. Oh, wow. And the younger of the two, arguably the more quick-witted, says, I'll be the last one. And the Talmud teaches us that is exactly what happens. First, she marries the older one. She has some kids with him. Then she's widowed. And then she marries the other one, has more kids with him, and eventually kind of lives happily ever after with him. Her second husband is Rava, who is the man mentioned most often in the Talmud, over 4,000 times. And the one who's really kind of responsible for bringing rabbinic Judaism out into the world. Ah, there's someone. Okay, well, if you remember, who's the lady with the phone? So, I came across this piece of Talmud years ago, and I was going, wow, what kind of girl, what kind of woman, how could she do that? And say both of them presented with two men. And I really, you know, so when Penguin asked, did I have anybody else in mind to write about, I thought of her immediately. And I'm going to quote Toni Morrison, the great writer, who said, and I actually, let's see, I have a cheat sheet here, so I know exactly what she said. If there is a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, you must be the one to write it. That's why she has a Nobel Prize in Literature, because she writes very nice stuff like that. But I knew if anybody was going to write Rav Hisda's daughter's story, it would have to be me. So I started doing the research, partly because I wasn't sure about Rav Hisda's daughter, whether it would be a book that I wanted to read. There are certain criteria to a book that I wanted to read. First one being, happy ending. At least satisfying ending. I mean, no offense to Shakespeare, you know, Romeo and Juliet and that kind of stuff. But for a book that I want to read, there's enough, like, terrible, nasty stuff you can read in the newspaper and the internet for free every day. If you're going to spend $15 or $3 for $40, Mother's Day's coming. Even if your mother maybe isn't going to read this, maybe you have a daughter who's a mother, a sister who's a mother, a daughter-in-law that you would like to be a mother. So anyway, I want a happier, satisfying ending. And all of Rashi's daughters have that. So Rav Hisdan's daughter, well, okay, she is widowed early on, but she finds love again and lives, said, happily ever after. And there is the advantage, she had two husbands. So that, you know, you remember that Doublemint commercial? I mean, we'll get two romances. And it does, you know, compare and contrast the... So that looked like, okay, definitely happy ending and good relationships there. Then number two, second criteria, I need it to be a time period that's good for the Jews. I'm not going to write love in the time of cholera. No Holocaust, no Spanish Inquisition, no pogroms, no persecution, none of that stuff going on in my novels. I'm doing the research here, and I do not want to be depressed doing the research. But as I already told you, 3rd century Babylonia is like prime time for the good times for the Jews. They're pretty much all prosperous people. There's no persecution whatsoever under the Zoroastrians. They're wealthy merchants, many of them, because the Silk Road goes through there. And so this is a great time to be a Jew. As a matter of fact, scholars say one of the reasons the Talmud was created and redacted at this time is because the Jews had like 400 years of no persecution, no famines and pestilence, in which they could concentrate on intellectual endeavors. And that's how we ended up with the Talmud, because of this nice, peaceful, prosperous time. So, good. It's not, you know, I've got a nice time to write about. And then we another criteria for writing this. For me, the research is the fun part. The writing is the hard work. That's why there's no Rashi's granddaughters. I've had it with the 11th and 12th century. But 3rd century, this was even more of a black hole in Jewish history than Rashi's time. I knew nothing about it. Nobody knew anything about it. This was going to be really exciting to research. And also, this is a crucial time in Jewish history. The creation of the Talmud, it doesn't get more crucial than that. Without the Talmud, there's either no Jewish religion or something very different. And so this is important in Jewish history, and I get to study about it. But it's also really important in world history, because during this time, the beginning of the 4th century, is when the Emperor Constantine converts to Christianity, and Rome becomes a Christian nation. And that means the land of Israel becomes a Christian nation when Rome becomes a Christian empire. And this conversion of Constantine pretty much changes the whole history of Western civilization to turn Europe into a Christian world. So we've got some really important history going on here, and I will get to research it. And people who are reading my book are going to learn something new. I'm not the 100th book written about Tudor England. There's not too much other books where you're going to learn. And one of the great things to me about reading historical novels is not just a good story with romance and conflict solved and that kind of stuff, but to go to a time and place I never been. And I can learn about it, and I can experience it, of course, from my comfortable chair with my indoor plumbing and antibiotics. But this would be a fascinating time period. So we're getting more and more of the criteria are lining up. But, okay, what about Rav Hisdan? What about his family? I don't want to find out he's a poor charcoal burner. I don't want to find out his wife died in childbirth. I don't want to find out he beats his children. So now the research gets tricky. The Talmud is completely self-referential. There is no index. I am going to have to search through, you know, to find... It's not a needle in a haystack. It's to find lots of needles, to find lots of straw in the haystack. Hay in the haystack, but I got to find out individual pieces of hay. You know, what does it say about Rav Hisda? Luckily, folks have, you know, especially in the Orthodox world, have written things like who's who in the Talmud. Mm-hmm. And Encyclopedia Judaica has an article about him. So I was able to do a little, you know, immediately find stuff about Rav Hisda and found out, whoa, you couldn't have picked a better family for my heroine to be in. Rav Hisda he's the George Soros and Bill Gates of his time. I need to find the name of the guys who in Colorado make the Coors beer. They're really wealthy.
Coors.
That's the name of the family? Yeah. Is the Coors?
Yeah. Bill Coors.
Adolf. Oh, okay. Okay.
He was the grandfather.
He was a bad guy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Rav Hisda is the Coors of his time because he makes all his fabulous wealth as a brewer of beer. And I thought, this is great. Rashi was a vintner. And one of the things I like writing about and researching is how they made wine in the old days. And how they made parchment, how they did it, you know, turned wool into from sheep into clothes. Well, great. I can, you know, you read Rav Hisda's daughter, you're going to know how to brew beer, how they did it back then. You're going to learn know how to take flax and turn it into linen. That's what the women in Babylonia did, and Babylonia was particularly famous for their fine linen. And all kinds of other things like, you know, that they talk about in the Talmud that women did. So Rav Hisda, also extremely blessed, fortunate man. He has 9 children, all of whom live to adulthood. We're talking a time period when 40% of kids do not see their 10th birthday. He has 9 children live to adulthood, all from one wife. And she lived, both of them live a quite long life. And out of those 9 children, 7 sons, the 7 proverbial sons. Clearly a blessed family. And I'm going, because this means that my character, my heroine, has options that the average woman in Babylonia will not have. She's wealthy. She'll be learned. She has power and autonomy. She's going to have slaves, not be a slave. She is not going to be grinding grain and doing laundry. She will have people who can do that for her, which give her the opportunity to be involved in court politics. And in a rarefied world, she's in the 1% of the 1% for Jews of Babylonia, which is, you know, to me, going to make a more interesting story with all the options she has available to her. So it looks like all the pieces of the puzzle of a book I want to read are there. Except there's one big hole in this puzzle, one big piece missing. The Talmud only calls her Hisda's daughter, only calls her Rav Hisda's daughter. How do I write a book about a character whose name I do not know? And here's where I get into the fine difference between a historian and the historical novelist. The historian must be correct. The historical novelist cannot be wrong. As long as what I write is possible, is plausible, it might have happened. Research shows that it did happen to some people in this time. I can put it in there. But I don't want to say something that's wrong. I mean, for example, forks are not invented in Europe until the 1400s. If I had had Rashi's family eat with forks, that would have been absolutely a mistake. On the other hand, I made Miriam a midwife in book 2. Nobody knows what she did. You can't prove she wasn't a midwife. It's possible she was a midwife. It's not like I made Rashi a midwife. So I thought, okay, I'm obviously going to have to create a name for my character. And I can't use any of the names that are already in the Talmud, because those already belong to other women in the Talmud. But on the other hand, I don't just want to make up a name. I want to find an authentic Jewish woman's name from Talmudic times. And you might think that that would be completely, totally impossible. And anybody who studied Talmud knows that when the sentence starts, you might think that means the answer is going to be no. So I did find something, amazingly. This is where the research really got fun. I'm looking for a source of Jewish women's names, and I come across something called Babylonian incantation bowls. Oh, some of you are nodding. Okay, you know what they are. I'm going to pass these around. You'll see them in a little. These are, actually the bowls are smaller than this. They're probably about half or two-thirds of the size of what's in this picture, but I blew them up. And they are written in Hebrew characters. They're written in Aramaic, same language as the Talmud. They come from the 4th to the 6th century in Iraq. So we are talking archaeological evidence contemporary with the writing of the Talmud. And they are clearly written by Jews. They call upon Jewish angels, Adonai Sabaot. They quote Torah. There are some of them even quote Mishnah. And I was ecstatic about this because, like a Bishop Baruch, which you say with the person's mother's name, and that's because the Talmud tells us that when you say an incantation or a spell for healing, you say it with the person's mother's names. And that's what these bowls are. The incantations and spells are to protect the people in whose house these bowls are buried under from demons, from the evil eye, from curses, from illnesses, from all kinds of ruchim and liliths and all kinds of nasty things that would cause people to be ill, or pregnant women to die in childbirth or lose or miscarry. And so every one of these has the client's mother's name in it. And these were first unearthed, literally, in the late 1800s, and most Jewish scholars ignored them entirely. They didn't want to have anything to do with this magic stuff. It was, some weird superstitious people that didn't know anything about Talmud, who were not intellectually enlightened, you know, the folk religion. And so most scholars just, you know, pretty much held their nose and looked away. But then in 1991, when the Iraq War came, and there was no security in Iraq anymore, the land was wide open, there's no police, there's nobody winding the store. And so you had archaeologists and looters, think Indiana Jones kind of guys. I mean, not the people that are looting the Baghdad Museum. We're talking archaeologists who, when nobody is guarding these sites, they went in there and dug up all kinds of ancient relics, and they found thousands of these bowls, almost under every house. And scholars now had to make a new change in their attitude that this is not some weird group, some minority. This is all the Jews. This is everybody who is doing this. And the study of Jewish magic suddenly took off. And I'm pretty sure it was Gershon Scholem, who's the expert on Kabbalah, but he's no Kabbalist. He says Kabbalah is nonsense. And I think he said, nonsense may be nonsense, but the study of nonsense is scholarship.
Somebody else
said. Oh, somebody else said it? Who said it?
Somebody we knew.
Oh, great. Oh, who shall remain nameless?
Shalom.
Okay. So somebody said that. And the study of Jewish magic is practically on the cutting edge of Jewish scholarship now. There's so many books, journals about Jewish magic. I was in Israel last year, and the Israel Museum had this incredible exhibit of Jewish magic, not just ancient Jewish magic, but even contemporary Jewish magic. So at first it's like, hallelujah, great, look at all these women's names. I can come up with something authentic for my character and for the seven sisters-in-laws I'm going to need. And indeed, I came up with the idea because when I looked at these names, I noticed maybe a quarter to a third of them, the women's names, Jewish women's names, were something or other duch, duch being Persian for daughter. And King Shapur, he is, both daughters are named Shapur Duch. And lots of women were named something duch. And that's when I realized, Hizda's daughter, that's her name. She's Hizda Duch. But by the time the Talmud got redacted and they're not speaking Persian anymore, they just made it the Aramaic and said Hizda's daughter. I am the novelist. I don't have to be correct, just as long as nobody can prove that I'm wrong. And I'm quite sure that nobody is going to be able to prove that Raf Hizda's daughter's name was anything else. So I went with Hizda Duch, even though my daughter said, oh, come on, you know, you can't pronounce it as long. I mean, can't you, you know. No, I can't come up with something else. That's what I've decided to be. But at least my daughter convinced me to give her a nickname. But it took me a little while, and I'm embarrassed at how long it actually took me before I started going, like, wait a second, what's in those magic bowls? What's with these incantations? Who wrote them? What do they say? What do they tell us about the people's lives? This is the archaeologic evidence we have from the time the Talmud's created. The Talmud doesn't get written down until, you know, years later. And so I started thinking, okay, does the Talmud even mention these bowls? What does the Talmud have to say about this stuff? And I knew there was a lot of magic and sorcery in the Talmud. I'd already found it for Rashi's daughters. And indeed, when I went out speaking about book one, almost always somebody would ask me, how could Rashi, this great scholar, believe all that superstitious stuff about demons and amulets and spells? And I had to tell people, this was not folk religion. This is straight from the Talmud. Rashi would have believed it more than anyone. And I'm going to actually send these around so you can look at them. This one with the attractive looking demon, as opposed to this one that just has like an unhappy face. The demon is bound. Often they have pictures of demons in there, and you'll see bars holding his hands. And if you look very carefully and can read Hebrew, you will notice that the last thing around this spiral is the Shema. And I'll pass them around. Make sure they get back to me. We do not want to leave them here.
Each bowl was different.
Each bowl was different. The only bowls that were the same would be the ones under the same house. So that someone... They were all written to order. As opposed to amulets, which were written with a stock phrase and empty space for the client's name. These are all written to order. So I started going through the Talmud to see what does it say about magic and sorcery and this kind of stuff. I actually went through the entire Shas to find what it says about these things. I can tell you that the Talmud names more demons than women, although someone pointed out some of those names are the same.
Is this Aramaic or Hebrew?
This is Aramaic. The parts that are Torah are Hebrew.
Yeah.
And so the Shema, of course, is Hebrew, and there's another piece of Torah in there also that's Hebrew. And the Talmud is shot through with magic and sorcery. There's, as I said, there's more demons named in there than women. The rabbis fight demons. The rabbis cast spells. Rav Hizda himself cast spells. The rabbis have magic contests. They're walking down the road, two rabbis, and a lot of times they tell us in the Talmud what the actual spell is. But when you get down to serious magic, it'll be, he said what he said, or she said what she said. And two rabbis walking down the road, and one of them says what he says, and all of a sudden this totally empty field is growing cucumber plants. And then the rabbi next to him says what he says, and the cucumbers ripen, turn into vegetables, and are gathered up into baskets by the side of the road. So he wins. The Talmud is explicit that in order to be on the Sanhedrin and the Beit Din, the rabbi has to know sorcery. Because what happens if a sorceress comes into court? She could influence the proceedings. So the rabbi, the judge, has to know enough Talmud to know the difference, first of all, between real sorcery and what we would call magic tricks. And if there is real sorcery, he can say what he says and prevent the court from being sent in the wrong direction. And you might wonder, wait a second, doesn't the Torah say something like, a sorceress shall not live? The rabbis ask that question too when they start talking about magic. And like the rabbis do in many places, this is one of those places where they take a Torah verse and it turns out to mean nothing like what you thought it meant. What the rabbis teach us is that the reason it says sorceress there, rather than sorcerer, which could include, the male includes men and women, they say sorcery is the province of women. Sorcery is a woman's thing. And how did sorcery come into the world to be a woman's thing? Well, the sixth chapter of Genesis, it says that the divine beings, B'nai Elohim, angels, whatever we want to call them up there, they looked down and they saw the daughters of man were fair. And they came down and they married them. And they had daughters. And the Talmud says that those divine beings, angels, fallen angels, whatever they were, they brought that sorcery, especially the healing sorcery, to women so that they learned it. Because 90% of these spells are for healing. They are for protection, and they call upon Jewish angels to help. And the rabbis are adamant that anything for healing is permitted. That spells and protection, certainly this is permitted magic, but in any case, the sorcery you're not supposed to do, according to the rabbis, is the way of the Amorites. Except there are no such people as the Amorites, historians tell us. The rabbis apparently created the name Amorites for these are the people who do the sorcery we don't do. All the other sorcery the Jews do is permitted. The way of the Amorites is the forbidden stuff. And the rabbis have a lot more to say about sorcery. There's a section in Tractate Shabbat, rather large one, where they tell you if you need an incantation for protection, how do you find a competent person to write it? How do you know the person you go to write these incantations knows what they're doing? How do you know if they're an expert? You don't want to go to somebody who is incompetent. And even if you go to someone who seems to know what they're doing, how do you know the spell they give you is a proven spell? How do you know that it's one that really works? Because only a proven spell by an expert can be those are the only amulets you can wear on Shabbat. All the other, and that would otherwise it would be carrying. And the rabbis take this very seriously on how do you find the expert practitioner, how do you find a proven spell? They do mention the incantation bowls. They call them Kasa de Harasha, cup of sorcery. They mention amulets much more often because amulets were more common. You had to be pretty wealthy to be able to afford these individually inscribed bowls, whereas amulets were ubiquitous. There's one place Josephus talks about one of the armies where the general wants to divide people into the army into two groups. Nowadays it'd be like count off 1, 2 here and there. And the general said everybody wearing an amulet over here and everybody not wearing an amulet over there. And there was nobody over there. Amulets are protect you. Who needs protection more than a soldier? But there were also amulets for, let's just say, more frivolous reasons. Very common amulets to win at chariot races. They found lots of those. And I kind of wonder how that works if everybody in the stadium has an amulet to win at chariot races. But I could also imagine today, you know, when the Yankees, play the Red Sox, you'd have everybody in Boston having their Red Sox amulet and everybody from New York having the Yankees amulet. Actually, you know, that could be the way to a fundraiser, you know.
The ones who lose are not the kosher.
Right, right. Something like that. And also, there were curse spells. Not all of the amulets and bowls were by nice people. And I'm getting a visual aid here that I will need soon. And there were love spells. They found bowls. When they first found them, they thought, oh, there was some terrible fire or disaster here because these bowls are all burnt and blackened. And then they read the inscription, and it said, just as this bowl burns, so may the heart of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, burn for so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so. And may she come to his bed at night, and may she become his wife. And some of them just said, may she come to his bed at night, and didn't say anything about her becoming his wife. And some of them were rather explicit about what was going to happen at that bed, and there were even a few that were two men. So nothing is new under the sun. And the Cairo Geniza, you've hopefully heard of. I always thought the reason they didn't translate most of that stuff was because nobody had the money to hire all the experts who could read the Arabic and Aramaic and Hebrew characters. But apparently, now that people are translating it, they've discovered that over 50% of what's in the Cairo Geniza is magic spells and incantations and manuals on how to do magic. And there have been scholars who have put together all these little fragments, enough of them to reconstruct these books. And now we have Sefer HaRazim and the Sword of Moses and all of these, which they can tell from the Aramaic, are from this time, the 4th and 3rd, 4th, 5th century. And of course there were, you know, in Rome and Syria, amulets is not just a Jewish thing. Jews there's good Jewish doctors are the best. Everybody thinks, well, they thought the Jewish sorcerers also, or sorceresses, were the best. Really, the ones they really thought the best were, of course, the Magi. I mean, that's the word magic comes from. The Magi are the Zoroastrian priests. And these are the guys who invented astrology. And this whole culture and time period is, when you think of it, it's guys on magic carpets and open sesame and genies in bottles. The whole culture's just, wrapped in sorcery. Yet the Talmud says sorcery is the province of women. They have lots of sorceresses in there doing spells. The rabbis consult sorceresses. The rabbis even consult the head sorceress. And I'm going, wait a second. The head sorceress? We have a hierarchy of sorcery? We have Hogwarts or something in Babylonia? How do you get to be the head sorceress? And then I read Okay, I knew Rav Hisda did spells, but I found out his daughter did spells. She actually knows a magical procedure to protect her husband, Rava, from the demons in the privy, which I will tell you because this is an important incantation you should know. And Rava is no slouch at magic himself. Rava creates a man out of nothing. He creates a golem. He sends it to another rabbi, Rav Zira, that he doesn't like. And also, you've probably all come across the piece, this is from Talmud, actually, you know, that you're supposed to drink so much on Purim that you can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Well, Rava is the one who tells us that. What you don't usually get is the rest of that sugya, where Rava is at a Purim party and gets so smashed that he slits another rabbi's throat, Rav Zira, the one he doesn't like. And then the next morning, when he comes to, he resurrects Rav Zira. Serious magic here. And then invites him to come to Purim next year. And what do you think Rav is? And what do you think Rav Zira says? He says, "No, thank you. I can't depend on a miracle every year. I'll have another Purim party. Thank you very much." So, there's just magic everywhere. But I started thinking, and this is again, historical novelist. As long as it's possible and nobody proves me wrong, I'm thinking, if sorcery is the province of women, who were the women who could make these bowls?
Oh, so the women wrote the bowls?
Well, they're sorceresses. Mm-hmm. But we don't know who wrote those bowls.
They were written by professional scribes.
Well, they're written by professionals.
The question is, were they women?
They were written by professionals. No question they got paid well for this. But the Talmud says this: the people with doing incantations and everything are sorceresses. These are women. So I am thinking, what women could possibly be literate enough to write these? And to have the literacy to write is a whole nother level than reading. What women would know Aramaic, writing in Hebrew script? What women would know Torah? What women would know Mishnah? There's a whole category of these bowls that include a divorce formula for divorcing a demon. The divorce formula is exactly the get from the Talmud. What women would know that formula? You could put it all together. No wonder the rabbis consult sorceresses and never complain about sorceresses and don't burn sorceresses. It's their wives and their mothers and their sisters and their daughters. Only women in rabbinic families would have this ability. So that means my heroine is a sorceress. And if she's a sorceress, and I have to start book one when she's a child, right? Because I got to have that scene with the two guys, then how does she become a sorceress? How does she train to be a sorceress? Who teaches her? Where does all of this training come from? And that's why book one is book one apprentice. Book two is going to be book two enchantress. And when I first started researching this book, I had no idea sorcery was going to be any part of it. And yet, there it is. So the research has really been fun. And I'm going to read you a couple of incantations. Unlike J.K. Rowling, who made up all the magic in her books, I'm not going to say that it's real magic. That's up to you to decide. But it's certainly authentic magic. It is from actual bowls, actual spells from the Talmud. And I'm going to read you two things. I'm going to read you first from a bowl, and then from an amulet spell from the Talmud. Here's the one from the bowl. By the name of Shaddai Sabaot Adonai, and by the power of the seven angels who are appointed over the 7 days of the week, Mikael, Gabriel, Samael, Raphael, Zadkiel, Aniel, and Kafziel, that you should stand with all your might, power, and strength to withstand all those who would damage and pain and inflict illness on the woman rogue weakness of heart, all kinds of pain, that she should be healthy and preserved, and she should not miscarry her fetus. I further adjure you, all kinds of liliths and ruchim that enter the entrails of women and spoil their offspring, in the name of Mikael, your master, and Ashmedai, your king, that you should move, go, flee, and keep away from this woman, Rone Bat Meduk, and that you should not ever come near to her. If you transgress against this, my adjuration, I shall strike you with the iron rods that are the four holy mothers, Bilha, Rachel, Zilpha, Leah. Amen, amen, Selah. There is no doubt that this is a Jewish incantation. It just didn't get more Jewish than this. Notice the four holy mothers are not the ones we're used to. That's because the initials of the names, Bilha, Rachel, Zilpha, Leah, spells Barzel. The Hebrew for iron. And I'm looking for my... Okay, in this room, a lot of Jewish women, their purses. Who's got like a little cough drop in a... Someone unwrap one of those things for me. And Barzel, spelling iron. Iron was known, even through Rashi's time, for anti-demonic properties. She's got a whole bag of them.
We have to get it.
Yeah.
What flavor did I get?
Ricola. Oh, it's lemon Ricola. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Right. Oh, by the way, Rashi teaches that sneezing in synagogue is good luck, because where else will a room full of people turn around and say, bless you? So that's how long they've been saying that in synagogue. Anyway, so Barzel meaning iron. Even in Rashi's time, women in labor, they brought their husband's swords and belts and all kinds of metal implements into the lying-in room. Nowadays, of course, babies are born in hospitals. There's so much metal around, you don't need to bring anything in there. So that is clearly an incantation to protect a pregnant woman. And they would have buried the bull under the house at some point before she went into labor. I'm going to give you another one, and I chose this. This is an amulet spell from the Talmud, but Rav Hizda gives us this spell. That's one of the reasons I chose it. And you'll see it's shorter, but in some ways it's similar. May it be your will, Adonai Savaot. This is an incantation for this is a spell for an amulet for a merchant, because the merchants had to, you know, go on the Silk Road, and it was dangerous, and they had pirates and highwaymen and bandits, and heaven forbid you should get to your destination and someone else has got the same merchandise cheaper. A lot of potential dangers for the merchant. So this is the amulet for a merchant. May it be your will, Adonai Savaot, that you conduct Tachlifa Bar Haviva in peace, direct his footsteps in peace, and uphold him in peace. Deliver him from the hand of every foe and ambush along the way. Send blessing on his handiwork and grant him grace, loving kindness, and mercy in your eyes and in the eyes of all who behold Tachlifa Bar Haviva. Blessed are you, Adonai Savaot, who are hearkens unto prayer. Amen, amen, Selah. Now, you notice it's very similar to the other one, but shorter. Yet, I would hope that quite a few of you have found this familiar. You've heard this before? Anyone going to come up? You know, do I have to? Thank you. Tefillah Chaderet, the traveler's blessing, the traveler's prayer. And this is an incantation spell for an amulet from the Talmud. How many of you ever heard of karmazuzas? How many of you have seen things like this? This little keychain that I got in a Judaic store in Cedarhurst, you know, one of those very from neighborhoods in Long Island. This one's got the whole thing. It's got Tefillah Chaderet on the back. And interesting for me, it's got the short version. Normally prayers, they just get longer and longer. This one is actually pretty much what Rav Hizda says. But it's all purpose. The other side has the thing against the evil eye. It has the fish. Talmud teaches that fish are immune to the evil eye. The evil eye cannot see through the water to the fish. It says mazel. Anyway, $3.49 at Judaica store. And probably you can get them almost in any synagogue gift shop. I don't know if you have a gift shop at JTS. No. Okay, so you can't get them here.
The library has something.
Oh, the library probably has collections of them.
Not metallic ones, but we have amulets.
Yeah, of course you have. You know,
we have written.
And you go online and look for Jewish amulet. You will find every kind of thing you could imagine, and that Israeli exhibit of Jewish magic that I told you about that I saw in 2012. They had incantation bowls from Iraq and Morocco written in the 1900s. This is not just ancient Jewish magic. This is 21st century Jewish magic. And there's quite a fuzzy border between... I'll leave you with this, and then you ask your questions, and hopefully buy lots of books. I do not want to schlep these boxes to Philadelphia on the train. There's a very fuzzy border, I think, between magic incantations, spells, prayers, blessings, particularly when you're talking healing, when you're talking asking for the unseen world to help in a situation where you are powerless. And this is not just weird folk magic done by a bunch of ignorant people. This is what all Jews have done, what Talmudic rabbis have done, and what Jews continue to do even today. And people are starting to give me amulets as I'm traveling. I'm going to pull out some of this stuff that I have been gifted with. This one from, you know, the Israeli bank. Yeah, and on the back is a travel, is a Tefillah Hadera, but it's a long one. It's this really long version. Somebody else gave me a, I think I have that in here. This Moroccan rabbi, like Baba Saba.
Baba Sali.
Someone gave me an amulet from him.
That's $20,000.
So, really? An amulet for Baba?
Incredible what that guy charges.
Well, no, this couldn't. This was like a laminated one. It couldn't have been the.
Yeah, but it may work.
Anyway, what do I know? But anyway, somebody gave me that. Blessing is expensive. No, it's not. It's $3.49.
That's not a blessing.
So, anyway, very. As I said, this whole magic world was something that I barely knew that it existed. Where's my bowls? Thank you. These actually are my bowls. I own these bowls. They are at home in my house. I got them in Israel when I was there, and I have the license and the antiquities. I didn't, spirit them out of without paying the taxes on them. Actually, my husband got me the pretty one, the one with the nice theme and the Shema, that was really expensive. My husband got me that for his birthday. I forked over my money for the one that was broken and put back together again. So thank you very much. I'd love to hear lots of questions. Two things. If you want to know when book two of Rav Hizda is coming out, which should be sometime in 2014, put your email here. You will not get any spam. You will never hear from me except for that email. And so that's why this is here. And if you brought books already, I'll certainly sign them. I don't need to have to sell them here. And you want to tell them about Lilith?
Yes, the people who produce Lilith, the Jewish Feminist Magazine, sent over a whole lot of free copies. And in this magazine, on page 38, is a fantastically positive review of Rav Hizda's Daughter by Ilana Krishan, who was my student. I can't remember if it was here or somewhere else, but it's a lovely young woman who lives in Israel. So these are all here for you to take.
There, you got some free stuff.
And what about your lift? You're going to ask for a...
Oh, right. If anybody drove here, I'm staying with David Kramer, the head of the library, who lives at 104th and West End. It's really close. I mean, I walked here. But unless all of these books get sold, which I doubt, I'm going to have to schlep books back, so I really need a ride.
Can anybody volunteer?
If anyone's says driving at all, it's not very far away. Okay. Oh, so good. Okay, good. Yes.
As a reward for volunteering, I will drive.
Thank you.
And I'm right at the corner. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I would have thought to connect the Aramaic incantation bowls to a historical novel. Even my doctoral work was on the Aramaic incantation bowls and their relationship to rabbinical Judaism.
Really? Okay, who are you?
I'll tell you.
Andy Gold.
Oh.
My point is this. It's everything you said is phenomenal. Just one or two little things. Every time you see in many, many of the bowls, there's a picture of a demon in the center, bound and tied, because that incapacitates.
Right.
Second, the bowls were found in every Jewish home in the
upside down.
Upside down, buried right under. And a couple of the bowls say, we're sending the demon back to the seventh depth of Sheol from which they came.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
So
that makes sense.
In addition, the spiral nature ties them up. Whenever you see the demons
They have to be tied up. That incapacitates them. And whenever you have knots and ties and things like that, their ultimate original purpose, even though we've given them further symbolic meaning, was to tie up demons. Even the tzitzit on the four corners of the world were protections originally. Also, there are many, many direct parallels. I can't say the Talmud quoted the bowl or the bowl quoted the Talmud, because they were both current in the language of the time. They're exact same phrases and incantations in the Talmud and in the bowls. So what you've done is magnificent. I urge everyone to be very careful, however, because...
Don't try these at home.
Writing them is probably good business now. That's why you have to be careful, because they're being forged now, because they can make money from them. So you have to be very careful, make sure they're authenticated when you buy.
Just like the Talmud says, how do you know that it's a real proven one?
And they were first discovered in the 1850s and first written about in the towards the end of the
1800s.
But the first major publication was Professor James Montgomery of the University of Pennsylvania about 1912. You can still buy his version, was reprinted by the University of Pennsylvania recently, and get it on Amazon. And they've been published many, many times before 1991, and been very much aware. The only other thing I would add is,
I'm trying to find my topic. I have
what
that.
What interested in me in the bowls was, I grew up.
I actually brought one of those, but I guess it's back in my room.
I went to Yeshiva, then the Jewish Theological Seminary. I even taught at Hebrew Union College.
Yes. Wait. Yeah. I need to sell books, and it's a quarter to nine. So
most of these places, the discussion of magic was forbidden. It was considered.
Oh yeah. In the olden times, they didn't. I mean, olden times. Like the yeshiva world, they do not study this stuff at all. Okay. You had your hand. You're waving vigorously.
I have my hand because I am a docent at the Jewish Museum. Please, everybody,
come.
There
is a bowl there.
Because there's a bowl there, and there's amulets. And thanks to you, I had read your new book. And when our new exhibition, we were walking around studying, somebody said, "What is that bowl?" And I said, "I could tell you exactly what it is." So thank you very much.
There's a whole cardboard
box. And please come to see our exhibition.
At the Jewish Museum. In the ladies' restroom under the sink. I don't see it, I've been told.
Yeah, right, I was going to ask that one.
Questions.
Okay, let's have questions, and I want to make sure people get up here and don't have to leave. Yes.
I want to thank you. One of the things, the nice things about the Rashi's daughter's books is that you put something in there which I never even thought about, and that is that Rashi is a contemporary of William the Conqueror.
Yes.
That was in the timeline, and it's also brought home, you say that he went off to fight with Guillaume of Bataille, and then there's also this whole business of the converse of the sheep, back and forth. So that was really nice. But you said you don't write about pogroms, but in one of the books you have...
Well, the First Crusade happens contemporaneous with the end of Rashi's life. And I didn't really have any choice in that. But it didn't happen to Rashi, and it didn't happen to his community. And that was partly why I didn't want to do Rashi's granddaughters, because after reading about the First Crusade, I really had it with that history.
One other thing, which you might find interesting, if you haven't seen it, I don't know how you could find this. Now, there's a movie, an Israeli movie, which is called Sofa Olam Smola. It's called Left Turn at the End of the World. They show it on El Al every once in a while.
I've heard of it.
You should see it, because in there it's about a Moroccan community in the desert, someplace when they brought Moroccan Jews to live. Where they sent them out in place. And
all right, well, I'll write it down. I'll get it on Netflix. You can get everything.
In there, there's a Moroccan woman who casts a spell and does very similar things to what you described.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that whoever was writing these bowls were professionals. They were well paid. They were not, you know, nasty ladies living in caves with pointy black hats that everybody shunned. Yes.
I read the book. I thought it was fantastic.
I didn't pay her to say that.
No, not at all. But everyone should buy it. You'll enjoy it. You just, you can't put
it
down.
She's waving a check. All right. Questions are over.
But what I wanted to ask was, but this is maybe a...
No, actually, I can sell books and answer questions at the same time, Rosh. She says a woman can do four things.
Four.
At the same time.
We have to do any more. But what I wondered was, what I worried about the whole time when I'm reading about, you know, these characters that I became invested in, is when these things don't work.
It's not for me. It's for Susan Lerner.
Susan,
I'm buying as a gift.
What happens when the spells don't work?
get a refund.
No, when the spells don't work, the demon attacks you, and you gotta, you know, you're in big trouble. And they
but
have that in the Talmud.
Seller of incantations. I mean, are there those, you know, somebody had a better track record than someone else?
Yeah.
Just because?
No, they knew. Yeah, they also, somehow they came up with this Full Employment for Sorcery Act.
Your baby died.
Okay, I'm going to help with the questions. Are there more questions?
Oh, good. You can take questions.
What's the next question for...
Okay.